So welcome to the Dharma Talk. Seems awfully bright in here tonight. So the theme tonight is the unburdened mind. Or, because the word for mind in Pali is citta, and it means heart-mind, we could say the unburdened heart and mind. Do we need a translation of unburdened?
Many words. In Hebrew, there are many words.
Okay. Yes, you know about this. So, to unburden the heart and mind is to find release from suffering, from sorrow, from anguish, despair. It's to find release from being caught up in the pain of the world. We won't solve the difficulties in the world with a heart of negativity, of tension, resentment, or bitterness. No resolution, no peace will be found that way. So we won't discover how to travel lightly in the world without a completely radical shift. And this radical shift, the Buddha's teachings are really revolutionary in this sense. This radical shift is to see afresh, to see anew. And it's to unbind ourselves from the psychological burden of the past. When I was in Israel in 2011, on my final night of teaching, some friends at Tovana said, "Radha, do you want to come to the revolution?" I said, "Yes, of course. Of course, I'm there." And so, in the streets of Tel Aviv, I had one of the most extraordinary evenings of my life. I walked behind a banner that said, "Revolution of Consciousness." This is what we need, do we not? And I thought it was such an inspiring statement. And so in order to live with a heart of peace, in order to unburden the heart and mind, this is what we need, this extraordinary revolution of consciousness, or a new way of being and seeing in relationship to the events of this world. So this is the theme tonight. So our memory of the past is always bound to me and mine. We do have memory, of course, that's rather useful. We need to remember how to do things. How to get home from here, how to drive, those sorts of things are unproblematic. But there's a certain type of psychological memory that only leads to sorrow and suffering. It may be that there's been an event in our childhood, for example, that's been quite significant, traumatic or difficult. It could be an event that's been rather unintentional. Someone has not meant to cause you any harm. Yet as a child, you've internalized something kept it with you, and lived your whole life, with life being coloured by the psychological memory, which is caught and bound in time. So this psychological memory maintains the self, the me, the mine. Truth is not a memory. When we really see the truth of things, it's not bound to memory. When we, on the other hand, meet life, bound with all the pain of the past, all the pain of the past through the many generations. When we meet life like that, we meet life with a conditioned response. We don't meet it with a fresh response, a new response, a free response. We meet it bound to our conditioned sense of who we are. The I, the me, who's been traumatized, hurt, wounded, rejected, unloved, and so on. Or the me that is afraid, the me that is so terrified. Because we may have had an experience in the past that has been genuinely terrifying. Yet, with the mind, with this sense of I, we give the I a continuity, and then the I projects itself onto all the various currently happening events in our life. For example, we might fear what people think of us. But that can turn into such apprehension and terror that we stop going out and we start staying home. And so we contract and isolate. For example, so the mind moves and rests and clings on various thoughts, experiences. And we have to get to know ourselves. We have to really understand ourselves in order to live with awareness, to live consciously, to live with freedom. We have to really begin to see and know this movement of the mind that's born of clinging, that's born of holding on to something. Krishnamurti points out that the word individual means a being that's not divided. That is, indivisible. But when we look and see, actually that's not our experience mostly. We find ourselves divided all over the place. We divide our experience into me and the world, self and other. We divide our inner life into all the countless aspects of ourselves that are very often at war with one another. So when we see with the I, from within the construct of the me, the I, rather than seeing into it, when we see with it, what we experience are our doubts, our fears, our judgments, our alienation, our isolation, our loneliness. Need I go on? Anguish, despair, anger. We see the world in terms of being and not being. We become caught in being. We say, I am, I was, I will be. Or to put it in the negative, we say, I was not, I am not, and I won't ever be. So, the Buddha had something to say about this. He said, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. So, if we say, I am is the identity. If we say, I am this, if we say, what's an example? I am unlovable. It's a view. If we say, I am inadequate, it's a view, it's a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. I shall be possessed of form is a conceiving. Or I shall be formless is also a conceiving. And the sutta goes on. Even the statement that I shall, the English word is percipient. It's not a very common word. I had to look it up. It means to perceive through the senses. So even when we say, I perceive through the senses, this, the Buddha says, is a conceiving. And then he goes on in his usual kind of dramatic language where he says, this is a tumor, a dart, and so on. So, the next step, very important. By overcoming all conceivings, one is called a sage at peace. And hearing this noise, I can tell you about being here last time when I had a conceiving about this. It was my first night in the Dharma Hall, and I was teaching with Leela. And before we came in, she said, Radha, we've heard gunfire from next door, and we don't know what it's about. It's usually a party or a celebration, so it's just fireworks or shooting in the air and it's not problematic. But we haven't heard any celebration, so I'm just letting you know. I'm just letting you know that there's gunfire and we don't know what it is. So this thought planted in my brain on my first night teaching in Israel. And so I sat here, right here. And then the sound came closer and closer and closer. Until I thought, uh-oh, what am I doing here? Because all of my friends in Australia had said, you're going to Israel? Are you crazy? I'm so glad I came. Wasn't crazy at all. But you see, the sound comes to the ear, and because of some memory, the memory of what Leela had said, the mental construction came, maybe I'm in danger. Just, this is the process. This is what we do. And this process goes on day in, day out. And so, you see, there's the seed of fear. Just in that small example. And then I thought, well, at least I've got a whole bunch of people sitting in front of me with military training. Maybe they can do something to help. I tell you, that was my thought. Okay, back to the text. By overcoming all conceivings, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. They are not shaken and are not agitated, for there is nothing present in them by which they might be born. Not being born, how could they age? Not aging, how could they die? Not dying, how could they be shaken? Not being shaken, why should they be agitated? It's not an easy text. So when we free ourselves from the construct of time, we discover the unaging, the unborn, and that which doesn't die. Then we travel through the world unburdened, unburdened by our little old selves, the self we construct. And I know that I've just made a leap. To understand this notion of the unaging, or what is revealed, when the sense of I and me ceases, we need practice. It's understood on the cushion. It's understood through direct experience. We cannot think our way to it because we reach the logical limit of the mind. So, now to something a little easier. Identity, or conceit, in the Buddha Dharma has three aspects. In English, when we say we're conceited, we generally mean, are we arrogant? But in the Dharma, conceit means identity. And the three aspects are that we compare ourselves with others, and we compare ourselves as superior to others, inferior to others, or equal to others. So just by the fact that we identify with who we are, we're already comparing ourselves with others. We're already caught in the mind of measurement where we fall short or we elevate ourselves, or very rarely we're equal to. So Dharma emphasizes neither clinging to a position of self or of not self. It's very important. Dharma emphasizes neither clinging to a position of self or of not self. In fact, it doesn't advocate any clinging at all. There's a wonderful verse in the text, another one. I'm full of them tonight. It goes like this: having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is nirvana, I tell you. The total ending of aging and death. So this is to be known through the direct experience of living with a heart and mind of non-clinging. So once we begin to let go, we get to know ourselves, we know what we generally cling to, we loosen the attachments, and we let go over and over and over again until the heart and mind is free, utterly free. In another part of the text it says, this world is anguished, afflicted by sense contact. Even what it calls the self is in fact unsatisfactory. For no matter what it conceives, the fact is ever other than that. Okay, so even the idea of self, and then when we conceive something, we construct. So therefore, already, we're not seeing the truth. We're looking from within a fabrication of our own making. So we see ordinarily rather erroneously, mistakenly. And bound to that standpoint, we cannot realize the truth. We cannot know it if we are caught up and bound. I think it might be time for a poem. This is a lovely, quite short poem by H.W.L. Punja, who many of you will know as Papaji or Punjaji, who lived and taught in Lucknow. And I had some wonderful meetings with him. He says, in very warm language and not such difficult language as the Buddha Dharma, I think. He says, love, the heart, this moment is the truth. To see this love everywhere, see only from love. See from the heart and you will see only the heart. But see from the ego and you will see ego. This moment of love does not belong to a me or to a you. So therefore, I am in love. So not meaning I'm in love with a particular person, but I am resting in love itself. So I'll read it one more time. Love, the heart, this moment is the truth. To see this love everywhere, see only from love. See from heart and you will see only heart. But see from ego and you will see ego. Don't we know that? This moment of love does not belong to a me or to a you. So therefore, I am in love. So the experience of our life can really be felt as a burden. And I often hear this in my work as a psychologist, of course. Many people feel they can't go on and express, you know, all kinds of suicidal ideation at different times. This expression is generally not a desire to end life, but actually to end the sorrow, the suffering, the difficulty, the burden. And this in the Dharma is called the desire for the non-existence of something. So it's the desire for the non-existence of the suffering. But unfortunately, and rather tragically for many people, it's misunderstood. And instead of realizing that it's the suffering that needs ending, people occasionally, too often, take their own lives. And this, of course, is a source of great sorrow and burden to others. We are also often burdened by our fears. Now, fear can be incredibly paralyzing, absolutely paralyzing. When fear takes a grip and sits in the consciousness and throws consciousness about, life can become exceedingly difficult because of anxieties and fears, anxieties about the future, anxieties that something terrible will happen, and so on. Krishnamurti says something fabulous. He says, fear is the movement of thought as time. So fear is the movement of thought as time. And at this point, I want to tell you another story. in Western Australia, some diving instructors were teaching people how to dive. And yes, you all know what this is going to be a story about. One of the diving instructors, a woman, was attacked by a shark. In Western Australia, they have very big sharks called white pointers, absolutely enormous. And the shark bit her hip like this. Her fellow diving instructor, in that moment, did something extraordinary. He grabbed the tail of the shark and pulled as hard as he could. He was in the water, so it was rather difficult, so he grabbed the tail of a great white shark. Pulled, and the shark let go. And then, in the moment, with the shark swimming in the water with both of them, this man, without any thought of fear, without a single thought about the future, with complete fearlessness, swam to the bleeding woman and took her to the surface and saved her life. An extraordinary event. So, in the moment, he wasn't caught in any thought of the future. There was simply clear, decisive action. That's all. Fearless action. When he was interviewed afterwards, very reluctantly interviewed on television, he said, "I am not a hero." He said, "I'm not a hero. Anyone would have done that." I'm not sure about that, because I don't know what I would have done in that situation. So he was incredibly humble. He didn't want to any particular accolades for this extraordinary act of bravery. This moment where he wasn't thinking of himself, his own life, the future, or didn't have any mental construct of what would happen. He simply did what was necessary at the time. So this is to live fearlessly, not caught by our fears. And another example, this time an example of discovering a way to unburden the heart and mind. A woman I was working with had been diagnosed with a progressive illness, a kind of illness that none of us would like to have. The only treatment for it was surgery. She'd had the surgical treatment and that had failed. And so she was looking at a life of progressive difficulty, where she would eventually lose the movement of her limbs and lose control also of her bowel and bladder. So she was devastated. She was the mother of four children. She was utterly, utterly devastated and depressed, because she thought, how can I have any kind of positive view of life with this kind of prognosis? So this was the difficulty. She said when she was first diagnosed, she just wanted to walk out in the snow and lie down and die. But she was a religious person, and her Catholic faith prevented her from doing so. So she couldn't do that, she said. So instead she came for treatment. And so I said, when you think of your family, what happens? What do you think of? And of course she said, oh, love. But then she said, oh, but I'm such a burden to them. Actually, she was the one who was burdened by her own thinking. And so then I asked her again, please again, really reflect on the quality of your relationship with your husband and your children. And she said, there's wonderful, extraordinary love. Fabulous, deep love. And so I said, in my usual way, does it have an end? And she said, no, it doesn't have any end. And in that moment, she had a kind of aha moment. She really had a moment where she said, oh, my husband keeps telling me that it doesn't matter that I'm ill, that it doesn't do anything to his love for me. She said, that's what it means to love somebody in sickness and in health. That's what it means, which were part of her marriage vows. And then when she thought of her husband, she started to weep and cry and laugh all at the same time. And she suddenly realized that love was immeasurable and vast, and that this love had the capacity to release her, to bring release from the very thought that she would be a burden on her family as she became more ill. And so then, of course, she began to realize that there were all kinds of wonderful, fabulous things that she could still do with her family, and that she needed to live every moment with as much freedom, love, and joy as possible. And this changed her life completely. The depression had lifted. The depression had gone. So this is release of the heart and mind through the realization of immeasurable love, love that doesn't end. Extraordinary. Beautiful. And again, from Pundiji, he says this, love is always loving you. Without this love, you cannot breathe. As without air, you cannot live. Love is meditation. Meditation is love. Heart has no frontiers. Meditate on this. You are this love. You are that. Simply be quiet and stay as such. So when we really be quiet and stay as such, in the language of the Buddha Dharma, we see the suchness of all things. The suchness of all things as they've come to be. And we touch that divine quality of love. Love that has no end. Love that is boundless. one of the Brahma Viharas, one of our divine abodes, our divine homes. And finally, from the Buddhist text again, the Buddha says, the world's end, so the, not the literal world's end, but the end of the world having some power over us, the end of being caught up in the world. The world's end can never be reached by means of traveling through the world. Yet without reaching the world's end, there is no release from suffering. Therefore, truly, the world knower, the wise one, gone to the world's end at peace, longs not for this world nor another. So our freedom's found when we no longer cling to anything. When we touch the heart, when we really live with love and recognize that which is unburdened, the unburdened heart and mind. So please put down the burden. Live with love. Let's sit for a few moments together. All beings live free from a painful past. May all beings know the end of suffering and sorrow. And may all beings be released. Released from all that burdens us.